reason I wanted to do this particular sutta is it has the 37 requisites of awakening in it. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in Rajagaha in the bamboo grove in the squirrel's sanctuary. I can't imagine picking a squirrel sanctuary as a place to do meditation. They'll climb all over you and do all kinds of weird things. Now, on that occasion, a number of well-known wanderers were staying at the Peacock Sanctuary. They don't care about noise so much. In the Wanderer's Park. There were some well-known wanderers in the park. Anubhara Vardharada, Varaharda, and the wanderers Sakyodayan, as well as other well-known wanderers. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One, dressed, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Rajagaha for alms. Then he thought, it's still too early to wander for alms in Rajagaha. In Thailand, we always got up right around 5 o'clock and stood around waiting at the gate of the monastery until we could see the wrinkles in our hands. And then we could go out and do alms round, which is actually fairly early. In Burma, they don't go out for alms round until around 8:30. And by that time, it's very hot. So you always came back, and the first thing you did was wash your robe and take a shower. I think the Buddha he went out for alms around 8:30 or so. Going out around 6 o'clock or 5:45, that means that the people that are going to donate the food have to get up around 4 o'clock to prepare the food. And that's a hardship. But even if going out at 8 o'clock, I mean, they still had to get up at 6 to prepare the food, so it still took some time. Suppose I went to the wanderer Udayan in the Peacock Sanctuary, the Wanderer's Park. Then the Blessed One went to the Peacock Sanctuary, the Wanderer's Park. Now, on that occasion, Wanderer Udayan was seated with a large assembly of wanderers who were making an uproar, loudly and noisily talking many kinds of pointless talk, such as talk about kings and such. Whether things are not so or are so. One of the things that I found in Asia is when you go to villages and you're in the evening, they get together and they start talking at the top. It's almost a yell. They don't talk normally. They talk very, very loudly. So this is a habit of the smaller villages. It doesn't matter whether it's Sri Lanka or Burma or Thailand. Then the wanderer Udayan saw the Blessed One coming in a distance. Seeing him, he quieted his own assembly thus, "Sirs, be quiet. Sirs, do not make noise. Here comes the recluse Gotama. This venerable one likes quiet and commands quiet and commends quiet. Perhaps if he finds our assembly a quiet one, he will think to join us." Then the wanderers became silent. The Blessed One went to the wanderer Udayan, and who said to him, "Let the Blessed One come, venerable sir. Welcome to the Blessed One. It is a long time since the Blessed One has found an opportunity to come here. Let the Blessed One be seated. This seat is made ready." The Blessed One sat down on a seat made ready, and the wanderer Udayan took a low seat and sat down at one side. When he had done so, the Blessed One asked him, "For what discussion are you sitting together here now, Udayan? And what was your discussion that has been interrupted?" "Venerable sir, let the discussion for which we are now sitting together, the Blessed One can well hear about it later. In recent days, venerable sir, when recluses and Brahmins of various sects have been gathering together and sitting together in the debating hall, this topic has arisen. It is a gain for the people of Anga and Magadha. It is a great gain for people of Anga and Magadha that these recluses and Brahmins, heads of their orders, heads of their groups, teachers of groups, well-known famous founders of sects, regarded by many as saints, have come to spend the rains at Rajagaha. There is Purana Kasapa, the head of an order, the head of a group, the teacher of a group, a well-known and famous founder of a sect regarded by many as a saint. He has come to spend a range retreat at Rajagaha. And then he goes through a list of four or five other famous teachers that are there. There is also the recluse Gotama, the head of an order, the head of a group, the teacher of a group, the well-known and famous founder of a sect regarded by many as a saint. He too has come to spend the rains at Rajagaha. Now among these worthy recluses and Brahmins, head of orders, regarded by many as saints, who is honored, respected, revered, and venerated by his disciples? And how, honoring and respecting him, do they live in dependence on him? Thereupon some said, "The Purana Kasapa is the head of the order, regarded by many as a saint, yet he is not honored, respected, revered, and venerated by his disciples, nor do his disciples live in dependence on him, honoring and respecting him." Once Purana Kasapa was teaching his Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers. Then a certain disciple of his made a noise, "Sir, do not ask Purana Kasapa this question. He does not know that. We know that. Ask us that question, and we will answer it for you, sirs. So he just broke in and say, don't ask this guy this question. He doesn't know the answer. Can you imagine doing that to the Buddha? It happened that Parinakasapa did not get his way, though he waved his arms and wailed, be quiet, sirs, make no noise, sirs. They are not asking you, sirs, they're asking us. We will answer them. Indeed, many of his disciples left him after refuting his doctrine. You do not know this Dhamma and discipline. I understand this Dhamma and discipline, they said. How could you understand this Dhamma and discipline? Your way is wrong. My way is right. I'm consistent. You are inconsistent. What should have been said? What should have been said first? You said last. What should have been said last? You said first. What you had so carefully thought out has been turned up inside out. Your doctrine is refuted. You are proved wrong. Go and learn better. Could you imagine that? Saying something like that? Go and learn better, or disentangle yourself if you can. Thus, Parinakasapa is not honored, respected, revered, and venerated by his own disciples, nor do his disciples live in dependence on him, honor and respecting him. Indeed, he is scorned by the scorn shown to his Dhamma. And some have said this, and he goes through all these other teachers, including Nigantha Naputta. The Nigantha Naputta is roughly equivalent to Sai Baba in India. And some said this, the recluse Gotama is the head of an order, the head of a group, the teacher of a group, the well-known and famous founder of a sect, regarded by many as a saint. He is honored, respected, revered, and venerated by his disciples, and his disciples live in dependence on him, honoring and respecting him. Once the recluse Gotama was teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers, and there a certain disciple of his cleared his throat, whereupon one of his companions in the holy life nudged him with his knee to indicate, be quiet, venerable sir, make no noise. The Blessed One, the teacher, the teaching is teaching us the Dhamma. When the recluse Gotama is teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers, on that occasion there's no sound of his disciples coughing and clearing their throats. Bad timing. For then the large assembly is poised in expectancy. Excuse me. Let us hear the Dhamma the Blessed One is about to teach, just as though a man were at a crossroads pressing out pure honey and a large group of people were poised in expectancy. So too, when the recluse Gotama is teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers, on that occasion there's no sound from his disciples coughing or clearing their throats. For then that large assembly is poised in expectancy. Let us hear the Dhamma, and the Blessed One is about to teach us. And even those disciples of his who fall out of their companions in the holy life and abandon the training to return to the low life, even they praise the Master and the Dhamma and Sangha. They blame themselves instead of others, saying, "We were unlucky, we have little merit. For though we went forth into homelessness in such a well-proclaimed Dhamma, we were unable to live the perfect and pure holy life for the rest of our lives. Having become monastery attendants or lay followers, they undertake and observe the five precepts. Thus the recluse Gotama is honored, respected, revered, and venerated by his disciples, and his disciples live in dependence on him, honoring and respecting him. But Udayan, how many qualities do you see in me, because of which my disciples honor, respect, revere, and venerate me, and live in dependence on me, honoring and respecting me? Venerable sir, I see five qualities in the Blessed One, because of which his disciples honor, respect, revere, and venerate him, and live in dependence on him, honoring and respecting him. What are the five? First, venerable sir, the Blessed One eats little and commends eating little. This I see as the first quality of the Blessed One, because of which his disciples honor, respect, revere, and venerate him, and live in dependence on him, honoring and respecting him. Again, venerable sir, the Blessed One is content with any kind of robe and commends contentment with any kind of robe. This I see as the second quality of the Blessed One. Again, venerable sir, the Blessed One is content with any kind of alms food and commends contentment with any kinds of alms food. This I see as the third quality of the Blessed One. Again, venerable sir, the Blessed One is content with any kind of resting place and commends contentment with any kind of resting place. This I see as the fourth quality of the Blessed One. Again, venerable sir, the Blessed One is secluded and commends seclusion. This I see as the fifth quality of the Blessed One. Venerable sir, these are the five qualities I see in the Blessed One, because of which his disciples honor, respect, revere, and venerate him, and live in dependence on him, honoring and respecting him. Suppose, Udayan, my disciples honored, respected, revered, and venerated me, and lived in dependence on me, honoring and respecting me, with the thought, the recluse Gotama eats little and commends eating little. Now, there are disciples of mine who live on a cupful or half a cupful of food a day, or half of a bilva fruit, or half of a bilva fruit's quantity of food, while I sometimes eat the full contents of my alms bowl, or even more. So if my disciples honored me with that thought, the recluse Gotama eats little and commends eating little, then whose disciples of mine who live on a half cup full of day should not honor, respect, and revere and venerate me for this quality, nor should they live in dependence on me, honoring and respecting me. Suppose, Udayan, my disciples honored, respected, revered, and venerated me and lived in dependence on me, honoring and respecting me with the thought, the recluse Gotama is content with any kind of robe and commends contentment with any kind of robe. Now there are disciples of mine who are refuge rag wearers, wearers of coarse robes. They collect rags from the charnel ground, rubbish heaps and or shops, makes them into patchwork robes and wear them. But I sometimes wear robes given by householders, robes so fine that the pumpkin hair is coarse in comparison. In Burma, I was given a robe that was made out of the stems of lotus. And it's very difficult to make. And I couldn't see myself wearing it because it was so fragile and I was going out into the forest, so I gave it away. But the people honored me that much that they gave me something like that. Don't sit with your arms folded, please. So this is, and the Buddha had robes that were given to him that were made out of gold. So he had some really fancy robes given to him. So if my disciples honored me with the thought the recluse Gotama is content with any kind of robe and commends contentment with any kind of robe, then those disciples of mine who are refuge rag wearers, wearers of coarse robes, should not honor, respect, and revere and venerate me for this quality. A lot of people ask about the color of robes. For years and years, I was wearing brown robes because if you go into the forest, you're going to get dirty, and it doesn't show the dirt as much. And when I came here, strangers would come up to me and say, "Aren't you supposed to be wearing orange?" Now, the color of this robe, and I have made some robes that were this color, is from the jackfruit tree. And you take the inner bark of the jackfruit tree and you boil it for a couple of days. And then you dye your robes. And when you get it just right, it is fantastic color. And every other monk that sees you, they kind of look at you and go, I want that robe. This is really a good color. But as you wear it, it starts to lose its great color. But when you see that it's done just exactly right, boy, you're the pride of the Sangha at that time. Okay. And when I was doing more in the forest than I was in the cities, the forest monks would get together right after the range retreat, and we would make robes, hand sew them, things like that. But now we don't need to do that sort of thing so much. A lot of people buy robes, and on the there's a month right after the range retreat where robes can be made, and it's called Katina, and that's the offering of robes to monks whose robes are torn or shabby and they don't look good, so they're supposed to offer it. But the tradition is such that I get so many robes that I had to buy a small hut just to store the robes. And if monks come and they don't have nice robes, I give it to them, because this is Sangha material. It's not mine personally. Every time I go to Malaysia, I come back with 15 or 20 robes. I have well over 100 robes at the monastery, but that is Sangha material. Sometimes robes are made especially for me, and then I have someone that's small and they want to ordain, and I can't tell the difference between a big robe and a small robe when they're all folded up, and I'll pick one that's made for me, and it's like twice as big as it needs to be for these short little monks. But we get it worked out in one way or another. Wearing robes looks like it's something easy, doesn't it? Takes a lot of years to learn how to wear a robe. There's many different ways of wearing a robe. And when people come and they ordain for a couple of weeks, do a retreat, and they wear robes, and I'm continually going around saying, fix your robe. Your robe's dragging on the ground. Fix your robe. It's not an easy thing, and on a windy day, a robe turns into a kite. So you have to know how to do it, or else you really have some problems. Wind is the hardest thing to wear a robe in. So, suppose at Udayan my disciples honored, respected, revered, and venerated me and lived in dependence on me, honoring and respecting me with the thought, the recluse Gotama is content with any kind of alms food and commends contentment with any kind of alms food. Now, there are disciples of mine who are alms food eaters, who do not eat unbroken alms food from house to house, who delight in gathering their food. When they have entered among the houses, they will not consent even when invited to sit down. But I sometimes eat on invitation meals of choice rice, many sauces and curries. So if my disciples honored me with the thought, The recluse Gotama is content with any kind of alms food, and contentment can mend that with contentment. Then these disciples of mine who are alms food eaters. Alms food eaters means they only eat what's put in their bowl. It's kind of a nice practice, but I always got way more food than I could eat. So when I came for alms food and we'd sit down and eat together, I would take everything out of the bowl. And if I saw that a monk liked a certain kind of food, if I had some of that, I would put it in his bowl for him. And being an alms food eater means it doesn't matter what they put in your bowl, you take it and eat it. But the way alms food is given these days, they're in little packets. In Thailand, they're little plastic bags. In Burma, they have these aluminum little things to put the food in. They would take rice and put it in by itself, and then there's these other little sauces and things. And it's kind of funny to watch the monks prepare their food because, oh, this one has something I really like. I'm going to put it over here in my bowl. And this one, oh yeah, we'll put that right beside it because those two really go together well. When I ate my alms food, I just started throwing it in the bowl. And the advantage of eating in a bowl is you know how much to put in. It gets to a certain level, that's all you need. But what I did was as soon as I got all the food in the bowl I was going to eat, I started stirring it up. Mostly because I didn't know what I was eating, and some of the things can be not so good by themselves. Like bitter gourd and things like that. But I found a trick. It didn't matter what I had in my bowl. If I had a banana, I cut it up in pieces and I could eat anything. It wasn't any problem. And sometimes I would be invited out to different people's houses and they have all of this food that was just unbelievable. I mean, it was top of the line food and it was really delicious. Sometimes if I was carrying my bowl, I would put it in my bowl. Other times I would just eat off a plate because that's what they had set out for me. The Burmese only eat out of their bowl unless they're in another country, and then they follow the traditions of other countries. And Burmese and Sri Lankans eat with their hands. So, yeah, like in Sri Lanka, they'll put out a warm water, and you pour your warm water in there, and you clean your bowl real well, and then pour it out. And then they have another bowl of water so that you can eat with your hand, and you want to clean your hand every now and then. You start doing this and clean it. I did that for a little while. It was a messy way to eat. I never did figure out how to do it correctly because you're supposed to take the food with three fingers and a thumb, and then you put your thumb underneath, and when you take it, you're supposed to flip it into your mouth. And I was real sloppy with that, so I started using a spoon. Suppose, Udayan, my disciples honored, respected, revered and venerated me and lived in dependence on me, honoring and respecting me with the thought, the recluse Gotama is content with any kind of resting place and commends contentment with any kind of resting place. Now, there are disciples of mine who are tree root dwellers, open air dwellers, who do not use a roof for 8 months of the year. When it starts in the rains retreat, everybody gets out of the rain. But sleeping under the trees, there's a lot of bugs that can get you. A lot of creepy bugs, creepy crawly kind. Cockroaches are real big in Asia, and they're flying cockroaches. They don't just crawl underneath, they fly on top and land on your head and whatever. It's hard to sleep that way. While I sometimes lived in gabled mansions, plastered within and without, protected against the wind, secured by door bolts, with shuttered windows. So if my disciples honored me for that, with the thought the recluse Gotama is content with any kind of resting place and commends contentment with any kind of resting place, then the disciples of mine are tree root dwellers and open air dwellers, should not honor, respect, revere, and venerate me for this quality, nor should they live in dependence on me, honoring and respecting me. Suppose, Udayan, my disciples honored and respected me and lived in dependence on me with the thought the recluse Gotama is secluded and commends seclusion. Now there are disciples of mine who are forest dwellers, dwelling in remote resting places, who live withdrawn in remote jungle thickets and return in the midst of the Sangha once each half month for the recitation of the Padimokkha. That's the 227 rules. We all get together when there is a Sangha. We all get together and recite the 227 rules. And that's kind of turned into a competition. If you really know the 227 rules, then you can do it in, 30, 35 minutes. If you make a mistake of one word, all the other monks will say, oh, you made a mistake, got to go back and say that again. But now they say it so fast, if you don't really know it, you can't catch a mistake. So you really have to know it well, and they do it in 25 minutes. So in Asia, it's really an interesting thing that the more you do something over and over and over again, the faster you are at doing it. So if you see a monk that's talking like I talk, which is very slowly, I would be considered, even if I went through the whole thing without making a mistake, I would be considered somebody that's a beginner at reciting this kind of thing, because I don't do it fast. But to me, if you really want to do it and do it well, you need to talk slowly so everybody can understand what you're saying. But I sometimes live surrounded by monks and bhikkhunis, by men and women lay followers, by kings and kings ministers, by sectarians and their disciples. So if my disciples honored me with the thought the recluse Gotama is secluded and commends seclusion, then those disciples of mine who are forest dwellers should not honor, respect, and venerate me for this quality. Nor should they live in dependence of me, honoring and respecting me. Thus, Udayan, it's not because of these five qualities my disciples honor, respect, revere, and venerate me, and live in dependence on me, honoring me and respecting me. However, Udayan, there are five qualities because of which my disciples honor, respect, revere, and venerate me, and live in dependence on me, honoring and respecting me. What are the five? Here, Udayan, my disciples esteem me for the highest virtue. Thus, the recluse Gotama is virtuous. He possesses the supreme aggregate of virtue. This is the first quality because of which my disciples honor, respect, revere, and venerate me, and live in dependence on me, honoring me and respecting me. I still live in dependence on the Buddha. If he wouldn't have gone out and made it a tradition of getting food on alms round, then the monks would have disappeared very quickly. And we're still living on his virtue. Again, Udayan, my disciples esteem me for the excellent knowledge and vision. Thus, when the recluse Gotama says, "I know," he truly knows. When he says, "I see," he truly sees. The recluse Gotama teaches the Dhamma through direct knowledge, not without direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma with a sound basis, not without a sound basis. He teaches the Dhamma in a convincing manner, not in an unconvincing manner. This is a second quality by which my disciples honor me. Again, Udayan, my disciples esteem me for the higher wisdom. Thus, the recluse Gotama is wise. He possesses the supreme aggregate of wisdom. It is impossible that he should not foresee the implications of an assertion, or that he should not be able to confute with reason the current doctrines of others. What do you think, Udayan? Would my disciples, knowing and seeing, thus break in and interrupt me? No, venerable sir. I do not expect instructions from my disciples. Invariably, it is my disciples who expect instructions from me. This is the third quality because of which my disciples honor me. Again, Udayan, my disciples have not met. When my disciples have met with suffering and become victims of suffering, prey to suffering, they come to me and ask about the noble truth of suffering. Being asked, I explain to them the noble truth of suffering, and I satisfy their minds with this explanation. They ask me about the noble truth of the origin of suffering, about the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, about the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Being asked, I explain to them the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. What is that?
Six R.
And I satisfy their minds with my explanation. This is the fourth quality because of which my disciples honor me. Again, Udayan, I've proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the four foundations of mindfulness. Here a monk abides, it says contemplating, and I say observing. Observing the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides observing feeling as feeling. He abides observing mind as mind. He abides observing mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. And thereby many disciples of mine abide having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge. Udayan, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the four kinds of right striving. This is right effort. Here a monk awakens enthusiasm for the non-arising of unarisen evil and wholesome states. How do you do that? The non-arising of unarisen wholesome states.
Guiding our senses.
Kinda.
It doesn't pull our attention.
Staying on your object of meditation. And he makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind, and strives. He awakens enthusiasm for the abandoning of arisen evil unwholesome states. Some people here still have enthusiasm for unwholesome states and get caught by those unwholesome states and come to me and complain. So let that go. Now, this retreat is real interesting because there's been 9 or 10 different people that had so much emotional problems in their mind that I was teaching them forgiveness meditation. As you practice forgiveness meditation, you get to let go of those things that cause sadness and fear and anxiety and all of these kind of things. And as you continue to do it, your mind gets more and more clear, and you are actually letting go of these old attachments. So there's a lot of psychological healing in the Buddha's practice by doing the forgiveness and not getting caught up in these old thoughts and feelings like you always got caught up by them and you were suffering by them. So that's how we let go of the First Noble Truth. He awakens enthusiasm for the arising of the unarisen wholesome state by and
sorry.
He makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind, and strives. He awakens enthusiasm for the abandoning of the arisen unwholesome state. He awakens enthusiasm for the arising of the unarisen wholesome states. He awakens enthusiasm for the continuance, non-disappearance, strengthening, increase, and fulfillment by development of arisen wholesome states. And he makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind, and strives. Thereby many disciples of mine abide, having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge. Again, Udayan. Now, these are this is the start of the 37 requisites of awakening. Okay, it starts with the four foundations, then it does right effort. Now, there's four bases of spiritual power. Again, Udayan, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the four bases of spiritual power. Here a monk develops the basis for spiritual power consisting of collectedness due to enthusiasm, determined striving. He develops the basis for the spiritual power consisting of collectedness due to energy and determined striving. Now, this is where a lot of people practicing the meditation, they wind up trying too hard because of the translation of this. You're supposed to try harder. I had 20 years of trying harder. Wound up with big headaches because of it. I mean, massive headaches. Really, really intense. Well, you're not trying hard enough. You gotta do it more. And actually, that's the exact opposite of what you need to do. If you have a lot of restlessness, if you have any kind of hindrance coming up, putting more energy into making it go away only makes it more intense. So instead of doing that, you need to back off. DROPS is a really good acronym. Don't resist or push. Soften and smile. Okay? He develops the basis for spiritual power consisting of collectedness due to purity of mind. So what purifies your mind? Letting go of craving. He develops the basis for spiritual power consisting of collectedness due to investigation. How does that arise? What happens first? What happens after that? It means developing your mindfulness so that you're very observant to how things occur. And thereby many disciples of mine abide, having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge. Udayan, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the five spiritual faculties. Here, a person develops the faculty of faith, which leads to peace and leads to awakening. Faith is kind of a weird word, especially in this culture, because faith to most people means you have to believe something whether you really know it or not, or you really see it or not. If I have a diamond in my hand, do you believe it? Do you have faith in what I say? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. But if I open up my hand and show you the diamond and close my hand again, do I have a diamond in my hand? Yes. Why? Because you saw it. It's direct knowledge. That's the kind of faith that is Buddhist faith, because you've seen it for yourself. He develops the faculty of energy. And that means learning how to balance the amount of energy you use to stay on your object of meditation. When you try too hard, you get a headache and you get restless. You don't try hard enough, you get sleepy or dull. And it's hard to bring that energy back up. So when you start investigating, one of the spiritual powers is investigating. I call it investigating your experience. They call it investigating states. Your experience tells you more. Okay. So learning how to balance your energy so that you don't have restlessness or sloth and torpor arising. Sometimes in one sitting you might have to balance your energy two or three times. But one of the big problems, especially with people starting out, excuse me, one of the big problems that people have, especially when they're first starting out, is they try to do too much at one time. Now, if you have a good sitting, and then you get up and you break your sitting, and then you start walking and you come back with the thought, "Ah, I really want that sitting to be good. I want this sitting to be as good as the last one." What happens? Because of that slight desire, you start out being restless. And then you have the idea, you know, maybe if I try a little bit harder, it'll get better. Excuse me, I have something in my throat. So you try harder, and then you have more restlessness. So you keep on going at it, and you start getting frustrated, and you start getting disappointed. And my sitting was so good, and now it's so lousy. And another thing that beginners get caught in is trying to use the 6 hours too much. And that causes restlessness. I can barely get 6 hours through one arising thought, and then there's another one right there. Well, you only use the 6 hours when your mind is pulled away from your object of meditation. And generally, when somebody comes in and they say, "I had such a good sitting, and now my sitting is so lousy," that's good for a laugh. And we laugh because, yeah, we know what that's like. We've done it ourselves. You're trying too hard. Just back off. Don't put more energy into it. Put less energy into it. And right then, your mind will start to settle down more. I was told for 20 years, you had to put more energy into it. You had to try harder. I was told by one monk in Burma, there's 50,000 seconds in a day. You should be noting 50,000 times. And actually, how much should you be noting during a sitting? You don't note. You recognize, release, relax, smile, and come back. Stay with your object of meditation as long as you can. So I was trained in a way that set me up to fail. And I admit, being a dumb American, I didn't know anything about Buddhism. And it took me a long time to figure out what the Buddha's teaching actually are. And when this book was first released, it was like, all right, now we have a translation that's somewhat good. The translations that we used before Bhikkhu Bodhi's book was from the Pali Text Society in England, and they were using archaic English. So you had to look up, what in the world does that word mean? And the dictionary doesn't give you the best definitions for Buddhist terminology. It's a special kind of language. And I try to give you as many definitions as I can. But it's a special kind of terminology that when psychiatrists, psychologists, psychotherapists get into Buddhism, they try to throw in their psychological terms. And it makes it a little bit confusing because they don't give definitions very often. So we have to be careful of that. And we have to be able to recognize that we just need to adjust little tiny bits at a time, so that our energy is in balance and we can stay with our object of meditation. The next faculty is the mindfulness faculty, and that's remembering to observe how your mind's attention moves from one thing to another. The faculty of collectedness. Collectedness means composed mind, a still mind, which is a kind of concentration, but I don't want to use concentration. That word is too misunderstood. They talk about deep concentration in athletics, where you see a baseball player that doesn't blink, because he's so intent on seeing the ball coming at him or whatever. That's not the same kind of concentration that the Buddha taught. The Buddha made up the word samadhi to describe what kind of concentration you need. The kind of concentration you need is not deep-pointed, one-pointed concentration. That's for athletics. This is the kind of collected mind, composed mind, at-ease mind that opens up. So you can don't have anything, you don't have deep concentration suppressing anything, where you can start seeing how these hindrances come up, and you start seeing more and more clearly how these hindrances are a necessary part of the practice. As you let go of a hindrance, you go deeper in your meditation. And a lot of you are very successful with that, and that makes me happy. Okay, and we have the faculty of wisdom. You know, I until I was 25 or 26, I was really into Christianity. And I went to listen to this guy, this minister, give a talk on wisdom. And I'm going, all right, this is going to be good. I'm ready for it. And he kept on talking about wisdom and using the word wisdom, but he never told you what it meant. Be wise. That's what you need to do. And what he was really talking about was being intelligent, not necessarily wise. So I went all the way through this talk that he gave, and his last statement was, now you can practice your wisdom. And I walked out going, I wonder what he's talking about. He never told me. What is wisdom? Wisdom is seeing the links of dependent origination. And you see them often, and you will continue to see them. You see how feeling arises, and then craving arises, and then your clinging and habitual tendency. That is dependent origination. You're seeing that. And you've been told every day about it. Okay. So these are the five awakening, or the five faculties. They call them spiritual faculties. And hereby many disciples of mine abide, having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge. See, each of these sets of the requisites, it always finishes by seeing with your direct knowledge. So you see it, you know it. People that are intellectuals, they think, oh, I've studied Buddhism for years and years, I really know it. Their intellect is very slow compared to seeing by direct knowledge. You ask them a question on Buddhism, they have to think about it a little bit. But if you ask a meditator, you can get the answers pretty quickly. Why? Because they have the direct knowledge. And that direct knowledge gets deeper and deeper as you go into your practice. Okay, then we have the five powers. Here again, Udayan, I proclaim to my disciples the way to develop the five powers. Here, a monk develops the power of faith, which leads to peace and leads to awakening. So it's the five aggregates, or five faculties, excuse me, again. But they are powers, because when you know and see from direct experience, you can't get talked out of it. You know how it works. And that is a power. And when you use these five faculties and you see, I've got some real good confidence. I've seen how this works. I don't have to believe what somebody else says I should believe. That turns into a power that your mind is unshakable. And that's the way it is with all five of the aggregates. New books. Then we have the seven awakening factors. Again, Udayan, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the seven awakening factors. Here, a monk develops the mindfulness awakening factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion, cessation, and results in relinquishment, giving up your attachments, giving up your false belief in a personal self. He develops investigation of your experience, awakening factor. He develops the energy, awakening factor. Now, the first is mindfulness. We need to have mindfulness with all of the different awakening factors. When you have dullness and restlessness in your mind, it says in the Samyutta Nikaya, then you need to bring up the mindfulness factor, the investigation factor, and the energy factor. So you investigate. As you investigate, you start pulling up your energy a little bit. Because it's interesting. How does this arise? What happens first? What happens right after that? So it's a real interesting process to be able to see and see how you pick up your energy. The joy awakening factor. The joy awakening factor is the last kind of joy that I talked about when I was talking about the five different kinds of joy. This kind of joy doesn't have excitement in it, but it just pervades all over your whole being. You feel happy. You feel really nice. When you have the awakening factor of joy in you, your mind is light and very alert. Okay? And some weird things happen in this awakening factor. One of the things is you can be sitting and you can be very nicely content and there's this joy and all of a sudden your eyes pop open. And you think, well, that was strange. I didn't want to open my eyes. They just kind of opened up. So you close your eyes. Your eyes open up. Now this is weird. So you close your eyes open up. You see a lot of Buddha images with the eyes half closed. And you hear all kinds of explanations of why that is. Oh, you should sit with your eyes half closed. Well, the artist is showing you that the Buddha had joy at that time because his eyes opened up. And you leave them there. Just don't pay attention. That's just one of the things that happens with this kind of joy. But your mind is very alert. Your mind is very agile, and you can see when it starts to fade away and a hindrance comes up if your mindfulness isn't strong enough. The next awakening factor is tranquility awakening factor. One of the functions of joy is when it fades away, you will feel tranquil. Your mind will just be very peaceful. And in the lower jhanas, right after that, when that starts to fade away a little bit, then you become very, very still in your mind. And you can stay with your object and meditation for longer periods of time. The stillness awakening factor is the samadhi. Okay, and I do call it stillness rather than concentration. Because you don't understand concentration, because the definitions are so ingrained in this culture that it is one-pointed concentration. So I consider concentration a four-letter word. We don't use that kind of language. But it's real nice, especially when you get into neither perception nor non-perception. Your mind just becomes still. And there's nothing. Oh, great relief. A desirable state to be in. Unless you want some excitement. If you want some excitement, you're not going to get into that state. Okay? And the other thing is the equanimity of awakening factor. When you have restlessness, bring up a feeling of peace and calm, or bring up a feeling of stillness, or bring up a feeling of complete acceptance of whatever is happening without resistance. Okay, that's what equanimity is. It's that complete balance of mind. Some of you have gotten into that state. You come in and I say, well, where have you what how's your meditation going? And you start telling me, and I hear that equanimity. There's no excitement. Your mind is really, really nice and calm and balanced. And then you walk out and I say to David, yep, he's got some good equanimity going. How's your meditation going? Fine, everything is fine. You have any distractions in your mind? No, don't. Everything is fine. It's that kind of voice. These seven awakening factors, when they get in perfect balance, is when you will experience Nibbana. Now, when you get into neither perception nor non-perception, and you stay with your object of meditation, those factors will start to balance on their own. Excuse me. They'll start to balance on their own. You don't have to do it. But before that, then you can use those factors to overcome restlessness and doubt, or restlessness and sloth and torpor. When you get into the higher jhanas, it's torpor. It's dullness of mind, not so much sleepiness. So they'll start to balance on their own, and when it's perfect, then you're going to have the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. When you come back out, you're going to feel a lot of relief. You can see very quickly these little tiny blips. Those are the links of dependent origination. And then the joy comes. Is that all? That's the way it works. Okay, and whereby many disciples of mine abide having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge. Again, Udayan, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the Eightfold Path. Here a monk develops everything they do with the Eightfold Path, and in this book it says, write this, right view, right thought, right speech. I don't like to use the word right, because if you have something right, you can have it wrong. And that kind of paints the world into black and white. So what I use is the word harmonious. Okay, and the first one, they call it right view, I call it harmonious perspective. Your harmonious perspective is seeing that everything in this world is impersonal. That's the perspective that you're developing here. The next fold of the Eightfold Path, they call it right thought. I really don't like that. That's really misleading. I call it harmonious imaging. What kind of an image do you have about yourself? I'm intelligent. I'm successful. When you hold that kind of image, you become that. I'm poor. I never have enough money. You hold that kind of image, you're right. You are poor, and you're never going to have enough money. I hold an image of myself as being very successful, and I am. Doesn't have anything to do with money or even material things. I have unshakable confidence that what I'm telling you is correct. It really, really works. And I don't want you to believe me. See for yourself. Then you start to have unshakable confidence too. But being prosperous, I'm very prosperous. I have 102 acres of land in Missouri. Gorgeous. It's in the forest. The closest neighbor is a mile away. It's quiet there. Don't have cars going by so much. Well, we do have some. Because if you go on our road and you go up to the dam, there's five or six people that work at the dam every day. So there's five or six cars that go up in the morning and then they come down at night. Occasionally we have some other people that'll go on the road. But you don't hear that much in the way of noise. I'm a monk. I don't have any money, but I've been responsible for building the cabins, or having the cabins built, for the meditation hall, for the dining hall, for the library. And it's worth about $750,000. I don't have any money. How can I do that? Well, I'm prosperous. I don't worry about money, ever. I let David do that. But he comes to me and he says, "Wow, we only got enough money for another 2 months, and then we're going to be absolutely broke." And I say, I don't care. I don't worry about it. Don't worry about it at all. And then in the next day or two, somebody sends us a check for $15,000. Somebody sent us a check for $45,000 when we were building the meditation hall. Somebody else donated a $50,000. I mean, it comes. If you take care of Dhamma, Dhamma will take care of you. You don't have to worry about this stuff. And it's really, really true. You don't always get what you want, but you always get what you need. When I was in Asia, one of the things that they used to like to ask me is, have you ever gone hungry? I said, not unless I wanted to. If I was fasting, I did. But no, I never go hungry. Wow, how lucky you are. Well, I'm prosperous. I spent 2 years taking care of a great monk. Every day I offered him food. Every day I bought food for him. I knew what he liked. And I did that for 2 years. And now I go back to Asia. I have so much food offered to me that it's just remarkable. I had a Sri Lankan stay with me for a while, and he came to Asia with me. And he started getting a little fat because there was so much food. I mean, this time when I went to Asia in November, or December, I guess it was, there was 100 people that showed up at the house I was at, and all of them had a bowl of food for me. And this is good food. I mean, you hear in Asia it's really good if you have bird's nest soup. Right? That's really good. And it's really, really expensive. It costs $100 for one bird's nest. I had it so much that I got tired of it. If you hold an image of yourself that you're intelligent, you become intelligent. You hold an image of yourself that you have a hard time and you can't get along with people, then you're going to have a hard time and you don't get along with people. If you hold an image of yourself that, I always have this fear and anxiety when something happens, then you're going to have that fear and anxiety. Or you hold an image of yourself that you're very accepting of whatever happens in the present, then you will become very accepting of whatever happens. And you trust Dhamma. You practice Dhamma. You give Dhamma away. You practice your generosity in all different ways. Especially smiling. Give your smiles away. Say things to other people that make them happy. You want to be prosperous? Guess what? It works. That's part of the Eightfold Path. The next fold of the Eightfold Path, they call it right speech, and that's really misleading. I call it harmonious communication. Who do you communicate more with than anybody else? Who criticizes themselves more than anybody else? Isn't that unwholesome? Is that being in harmony with yourself? You can do 25 things in a day that are absolutely brilliant. It helps a lot of other people and makes them happy, and you do one thing in that day that's a little bit marginal in your mind. What do you think about? What do you criticize yourself about? What do you beat yourself up about? You have to understand sometimes we're going to make mistakes. And if you see you made a mistake, you don't have to criticize yourself for it. You just say, okay, I'm not going to do that again. That didn't work. So you learn from your mistakes. Don't indulge in criticizing yourself. Why? Do you take it personally? So now you're caught up in craving and your old habitual pattern of, well, I did this before and I really suffer for that. You don't have to. That's what 6 hours are for, right? The next fold of the Eightfold Path, they call it right action. And I call it harmonious movement. And that has to do with energy, not trying too hard, not trying to stuff things away. It's a harmonious movement of mind's attention. The next fold of the Eightfold Path, they call it right livelihood. I've always got a kick out of that. Right livelihood, I call it harmonious lifestyle. What are you putting in front of your face? Read the paper every day? Why do you want to do that to yourself? Because it makes you think about all the troubles in the world. Your mind tends towards the negative. Unless you're in Malaysia on Wednesdays, then they have a page of positive news. I'll give you an example of what I read in one of the things. It was a crack up. This guy had this pig and he was using it as a house pet. And he was kind of like Arnold. And he wasn't a big pig, but he did something and he made his owner kind of angry at him, and he said, "I'm going to turn you into bacon." And this pig goes over, this is when they had wires on the phone. He goes over to the phone and pulls it off the shelf. And with his nose, he dialed 911. And they said, "This is 911, how can I help you?" And he started squealing. Now that's the kind of news I think is really newsworthy, you know? That's really good stuff. But I also had a student that was coming to me and, "Oh, I've got these really terrible nightmares. Every night, these nightmares come up and they wake me up and I wake up frightened." And I said, "Well, that's kind of odd. Why is that happening?" She said, "I don't know. But it always seems to happen after I go to the movies." "What kind of movies you like?" "Oh, I love horror movies." "Well, don't do that anymore." "Oh, but I really love it." I said, "Well, don't come to me and complain about your dreams. What are you putting in front of your mind? What kind of livelihood is that?" Be careful with the kind of things you read, the kind of things that you put in front of your mind. happy things, helping people, doing that kind of thing. That's what right livelihood is all about. Now the next fold of the Eightfold Path, they call it right effort, and we all know what right effort is, so I'm not going to go into that, but I do call it harmonious practice. And your mind, when your mind is nice and balanced, you use the six R's when necessary, you're in harmony with everything. The next fold of the Eightfold Path, they call it right mindfulness. And because of the use of mindfulness now, I mean, they even have magazines called Mindfulness Magazine. Try reading that and see if you can find out what mindfulness means. It doesn't work. So I call this harmonious observation. You observe how mind's attention moves. And the last fold of the Eightfold Path, they call it right concentration. Now in the suttas, it gives a very explicit definition of right concentration, and that is the jhanas. People that practice straight vipassana, they don't like that definition. And they say, well, right concentration is neighborhood concentration or moment-to-moment awareness. That is not in the suttas at all. One of the definitions of being a Theravada monk is that you have to take some commentaries to be the same as the Buddha's teaching. And one of those commentaries is the Visuddhimagga that misleads people a lot. And it adds in the neighborhood concentration or moment-to-moment awareness. And they kind of made that up. And there's three commentators that you have to take to be the same as the Buddha. One is Buddhaghosa with the Visuddhimagga. One is Buddhadasa, and he was around the time of Buddhaghosa. And there was a teacher that was 200 years before then that started the college that Buddhaghosa went to in southern India. The name was there, and I was just about ready to say it. And
Dhammapala,
thank you. If you take their teaching to be the same as the Buddha's, then you're considered a Theravada monk. And I got disillusioned with that, with those kind of commentaries. They don't agree with what it says in the suttas. So I went to one of my monk friends that's been a monk for 50 years. He spent about 25 years in India, and then he moved to England. And I said, you know, I really have a problem because I don't take the Visuddhimagga as the Buddha's teaching. I just can't. And he said, then you can't be a Theravada monk. And I went, oh man, what am I doing to myself? This is a problem. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said, oh, don't worry, you're still a Buddhist monk. You're just not a Theravada monk. And I've since started my own tradition that we call Suttavada. It's the study of the suttas. And that was around during the, right after the Buddha died. It was one of the 17 different traditions that started up after the Buddha died. It didn't last very long. And they like to get together and argue, basically, is what it boiled down to. We don't want arguing in our Suttavada. We take what the Buddha says. We might argue about the use of a particular word because it doesn't work so well. But we always wind up agreeing with it, okay? So, let's share some merit. May suffering ones be suffering free and the fear stress fearless be. May the greedy shed all grief and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we thus acquire for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Now, in Buddhism, some of the people think naga means snake. But it depends on how you spell it with the diacritical accents. This naga means arahat. I thought you did.